those of you who haven't, who weren't here, it seems as if really our task this week is summarized nicely by a comment that one of the staffers made over in the Vespers on Wednesday night when we were asked to think about a just world. One of the staffers said, we need to eliminate the scientific method. Now, I think that is part of our theme because I'm interpreting that to mean that what we really need to do is really come up with different ways of thinking about science, the science that that's represented by the phrase, the scientific method. When we say the scientific method, we think of a certain enterprise, we think of a certain kind of individual, we think of certain results from that kind of activity. So what we've been looking at is different ways of thinking about science so that we can move towards this more just world. As I said last time, I don't think we can eliminate science as a way of knowing, because we've been using it as a way of knowing since the dawn of the age. And what we really need to recognize is that there are different ways of knowing. We need to understand the limitations of each of those ways of knowing and incorporate them into our being and thinking. So we've talked about how to put science back into society, that is to think of science as the web of human activity surrounding science. So that means that you all are part of the scientific enterprise because you all use the results of scientific knowledge. And if we put that web there, we're really placing science back into society, and that really will help us make it a more human endeavor. The other thing that I've been stressing this week is that, again, we need to think of science not as this huge monster, as someone thought in an earlier session that we were perhaps doing, but rather we need to think of science as a way of knowing about natural phenomena, and that has limitations. So what I'd like to do is a demonstration to think about some features of science as a way of knowing. And in order to do this demonstration, I need to do a little bit of segregation, I think, here. What I'd like to do is divide us into practicing scientists, or those of us who have had a couple years of science training. All right, so how many would fall under that category?
A couple years of science training.
Yeah, a couple years of science training. All right, so those of you who've got your hands up, would you please just watch for a while, and we'll ask the other people to tell us what they see in this demonstration. Okay, so you'll have your turn to talk. We're going to let the lay people go first for a change, okay? Now, I'm not trying to put the rest of you on the spot here, okay? I just want to say you just walked in off the street, you didn't hear me, you know, you don't know what the title of this session is, you're just here, okay? And all I'd like you to do is report after this demonstration is done about what you see, all right? And then we'll ask our scientists and science experience folks to tell us what they see, all right? I want you to know that I have permission from the fire chief to do this little demonstration. He knows that it's going on, so.
Oh, boy.
You may recognize this.
I told you.
All right, whoops.
You need a helper?
No, I think I can get it.
Okay. Like a band of white.
Yeah. Minimal cooking. Yeah. Probably
gonna
suck the smoke line here.
Yeah.
In a minute, maybe
about. I wonder if the tape is
picking up. Well, anyway. Let me just open the door here. Smoke out of here. Okay. So what did you all see there?
Burned a Dorito.
I burned a Dorito? Okay, what did you see?
Go ahead.
What did you see? Okay, you didn't see anything? Okay. What did the rest of you see?
You took a match and you lit a chip that my understanding is has, my guess is it's probably got something other than usual chip material on it in order to make it burn like that.
Oh, interesting. Okay. What else?
I see, what is it, made out of soybean oil or something. It's made out of a flammable product.
Okay.
And that's what burned.
Okay. All right. Yeah, you got one? What'd you see?
I heard it.
You heard? What did you hear?
That's right. We not only see, but what did you hear?
I heard it sizzle.
It was sizzling, right? And what other sense could we use now?
It smells.
Can't smell it yet.
You can't smell it yet? Oh, wow, it's overpowering over here.
And then you extinguished it with some water.
Okay, all right. Do you see anything else, anybody?
You broke apart.
You broke apart? Okay, good.
Oh, now I smell it.
You smell it now?
Yeah.
What else did you see?
Lots of smoke.
I didn't see any smoke from over here.
You didn't see any smoke from over here, but you saw some.
Yeah, I could see.
And it burned at a rapid rate.
Burned at a rapid rate, yeah.
It really flamed.
It really flamed? You saw a lot of flame?
It flamed after it took a while to start turning.
Turned black. Uh-huh.
It almost seemed like it didn't burn upward like a piece of paper. It didn't disintegrate as it went up. It was like the surface of it burned.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Anything else? Anybody saw? All right. Okay. Let's now ask our science friends what they saw. I'd be interested to hear what you all saw. I'm going to put you on the spot here.
May I go first?
What's that?
I say, may I go first?
Okay.
Well, I saw the application of a very smooth, nicely controlled oxidation tape administered to another solid material, and suddenly the oxidation was very chaotic. It was just totally uncontrolled, and it caused discomfort to the person doing it. And then they saw a change of state, the solid into the gaseous state, which, you know, commonly called smoke. And last was that wonderful classical demonstration of gravity in action.
Okay, so you saw some gravity there, okay?
Look different up there.
Right. Yeah. What about the rest of you who's got some science training? What did you see?
Combustion reaction.
Okay, combustion reaction. Hang on. What else?
Heat production.
Okay, you saw heat being produced.
Well, I couldn't quite feel it from here, but I'm assuming there was heat there.
Okay. Okay. Anything else you saw? What else happened?
Probably a lot of corn oil burning.
Okay, you saw oil burning?
Probably. You fry corn chips in oil.
All right, which is what you mentioned earlier. Okay, anybody else with some science background, what they saw?
Burning Dorito.
You saw a burning Dorito? All right. Did any of you with science training see some atoms and molecules there in action? I saw some atoms and molecules, and I saw some energy.
Well,
would you agree with that?
That's what I said about heat production.
Okay, so...
I didn't see any atoms and molecules.
Oh, I saw
no,
the atoms.
You assume they're there, but, you know...
You assume that they were there.
But I saw the realization of it.
Okay, all right. So, we assume that atoms and molecules were present.
You want to be scientific, the kinetic energy was increasing.
Okay, we saw some energy transformations. Okay, we saw the energy of the molecules being converted into the energy of heat, light, and motion. Okay, all right. Well, you can see the point I'm trying to make here is that scientists see from a particular perspective, all right, so that I like to think of it as a particular pair of lenses that one puts on when one is thinking scientifically, right? So that I, for example, saw atoms and molecules, and in fact, whenever I'm thinking about the natural world from a scientific perspective, what I see are atoms and molecules, and that means living and non-living. So when I have my scientific glasses on and I'm looking out at you, what I see are collections of atoms and molecules, right? Doing chemical reactions or physical interactions, all right? And I think you all realize that particular pair of lenses that I wear and our other people here with this vocabulary wear comes from our education, right? It takes a certain amount of training to be able to see these things. But the point I want to make from all of this is, again, this feature of science is a way of knowing, and that is that we see these abstract things, that I saw energy, okay? I don't mean literally saw, but I could imagine that energy was there, that I imagined those atoms and molecules doing their thing there, all right? So that really chemistry is a system of abstract ideas to explain things that happen in the world. And if you're going to have abstract ideas, you've got to express them with language. So that means then, fundamentally, that chemistry is a language system. Because it's all about these abstract things that you really can't see. And even features of them are very abstract. I'd just like to talk a minute about this particular reaction because I think it's very interesting. You notice that you described it as a combustion reaction. Where else do you see the combustion reaction? What else uses the combustion reaction?
The match.
Oh, okay, whenever you strike a match, you're doing a combustion reaction.
Cellular metabolism.
Yeah, I want to get to that in just a second. What about your gasoline engine? How does that work?
Combustion.
By combustion. What about the campfire out here in the camp ring over there? Or the fire we had last night, or a couple nights ago for Vespers? Mm-hmm. That's the combustion reaction, too.
Are the gas stoves in the kitchen?
Gas stoves in the kitchen, natural gas, heating your home, or gas is heating, used to cook on the stove. That uses the combustion reaction, all right? Whenever you do the combustion reaction, if you can get complete combustion, you get two products, carbon dioxide and water. What happens to you when you go, what are you breathing out?
Carbon dioxide.
Where does that carbon dioxide come from? It comes from the combustion reactions that you're doing with food. So metabolism, and what we're doing right now, I'm sure we're all doing it fairly heavily at this point, is we're doing combustion reactions. So fundamentally, eating is about doing combustion reactions so that you can fuel your organism. So if you don't like the taste of things, you can always remind yourself that you're just fueling fire for your combustion engines. Or, as we've gotten to the technical term over here, cellular metabolism. All right, so I just want to make that connection because I think that's a nice connection, that we're doing combustion as well as we use combustion to move on to function. Okay, so again, the reason why we did this was not really to talk about combustion, although it's very interesting, was to again remind ourselves that we've got this abstract stuff going on that scientists use to explain natural phenomena. So again, many of you have already figured out that my point of view is that science is constructive knowledge, that human beings construct the scientific knowledge. And that, again, is one interpretation. What I'd like to focus on tonight is, what does that mean for being in the classroom? Because, as we said, this perspective comes from lots of years of being in the classroom. I think many of us can attribute to the number of years. And the point that I want to make here is that how we teach is related to what we think about the knowledge. So because I believe that knowledge is constructed, I'm going to teach in a certain way. All right? And that also tells us perhaps about how science is currently being taught and what those people who teach it that way believe about the knowledge. So let me just write that down here. Alright, so I think you can see where I'm headed as a teacher. My job is then to help facilitate the reconstruction of the construction in students' minds, or in students, with students. All right, we work on that reconstruction together. And I think this is a slightly different approach than I usually find in science classes, again, because I have this particular interpretation. I should say it's not my own interpretation, that there are other people who share this interpretation with me about scientific knowledge. You might ask, well, how do you help students reconstruct? Well, if you're going to do construction, what do you need to do construction?
Materials.
What's that?
Materials.
You need things to construct with, and so you need ideas. You need a context. All right, so my particular context is chemistry. Other people have other contexts in science. What else do you need if you're going to build something?
Tools.
All right. So with this particular approach, what you really have to help students develop is tools for developing this ability to get to science as a way of knowing. Well, how do you develop these tools? One thing that you can do is use history. You can show how in history ideas were constructed. So you can talk about how people developed the idea of the atom. And I should tell you that at the moment, there's not much history being taught in curriculum. It's always in the first chapter, and of course you whiz through the first chapter so that you can get on to more important things. So you lose that opportunity to use history as a guide. Another thing that I like to do is use my own experience. I have had to reconstruct the knowledge in my head in order to be teaching it, right? So I could say to my organic chemistry students, for example, here's how we organize this material. 1, 2, 3, 4. We have 4 major points that we hang all of organic chemistry on. Right? So we can use my experience as a guide. And then another very helpful tool is how students are doing it themselves. Right? As you construct, you figure out how to do it, right? And just because I do it a particular way doesn't mean that you're going to build something the same way. And so what you can do is get students to talk about how they're building the material in their heads. And you really find some interesting things. I'm always learning new interpretations because their buildings are just slightly different than my buildings, but they're as functional because we have this consensus about what these constructions ought to look like in the end. Let me just say 2 things about this, and then we'll look at your experiences in the classroom and some other things coming from this approach. I think you can see that what this approach does is it puts human beings back into this. That I don't know about your experience, but I've always felt that when I was being trained in my educational experience that I was a mind, that I was a brain, that you know my professors were looking out and seeing these hundreds of brains that they had to pour information into. Right? So what I'm trying to suggest is that human beings do this project of construction, and so what that means is you've got to deal with the anxiety and the fear and all that stuff. That if it's just a pure brain, then you don't have to worry about anything else. That if it's a pure brain, all you have to do is pour it in, right? But I'd like to suggest that we have to be concerned with people's attitudes as we try to help them develop skills. And the other thing about this then is, this kind of approach is, that it does make it a collaborative approach. That I don't know what your science experience was, but mine was really lonely. All right? That it was very competitive. It was back in the days when students used to sabotage each other's experiments because everyone was trying to get into med school. So I think with this kind of construction project, you can turn the experience into a collaborative process. And what that ultimately does then is build community in the classroom. So students begin to work with one another across different experiences and what have you. And so you know everyone gets to know each other and you have a lot of fun doing it. So what I'd like to do is compare these 2 kinds of classrooms, and as I do that, if that triggers any experience that you had in science, please feel free to talk about your experiences. I'd like to hear about where you've been or maybe where you've known other people have been, your kids or what have you. So let's just take a minute to compare these different kinds of classrooms. Again, does anybody have any questions or comments about anything I've said so far? About burning potato chips? Okay, I've titled this the usual science classroom, and then what I'm suggesting is that there's a different kind of science classroom that one can have. So in the usual science classroom, learning is usually acquiring objective knowledge, which only gifted people do best. Right? Does that trigger anything for anybody? Yeah.
Well, it just does. Yeah.
What's the usual experience that I should ask you all? What's the usual experience you have when you tell somebody that you're in science?
They shrink in fear.
They shrink in fear, they say. Oh my God. How about you? Have you had that experience being in science?
They realize they don't know how to spell.
They realize? Have I spelled something wrong here?
No, me. Oh. I don't know how to spell.
You don't know how to spell.
Most engineers are the world's worst spellers. Uh-huh. That's what I hear every time.
Really? Uh-huh. Because, of course, they don't take any English, right?
Exactly.
Uh-huh. How about your experience when people find out you're a scientist?
Can't say right now.
Okay. So what I'd like to contrast that with would be the idea, again, that learning is about reconstructing the knowledge that has already been constructed by somebody else. And so that really means that most people can do it.
Yeah, that's a real different idea. I mean, that whole idea of reconstructing it, because I remember in science class where, you needed to come up with the teacher's answer, and you needed to do it the way the teacher did it. And if you came up with a different answer or a different method, then you got a D. And the only way you could do it would be if you redid what they, there was only one way to do it.
Uh-huh. I think I need to make it clear that what I'm saying here is that the construction that a student has to ultimately end up with has got to be the one that the consensus of the community has. Mm-hmm. That not any old construction will do, but it's got to be the construction that everyone has agreed upon is the construction of how it works.
But it's not necessarily the teacher's construction.
It doesn't necessarily have all the aspects of the teacher's construction. Yeah. So maybe what you're suggesting is an experience that many people have, and that is the teacher's the expert and authority and somehow expects you to already come to the level that they're at.
Yeah.
That they have the PhD and you're supposed to, as a freshman chemistry student, know everything a PhD knows. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's one way of saying that in a concrete way. Right, what about this one? Acquiring knowledge in this other kind of classroom is usually through repeated problem solving and memorization. Right. What kind of problem solving experiences have you had? One thing I was thinking when I first started teaching was that I came out of a culture where you played a lot of games. You know, you played Monopoly, you played cards, all our time we played games, and so that when you went into the chemistry classroom and your task was to solve a problem, it became like a game. And so you had all these gaming strategies, right, that you could use because you developed them outside the classroom. And what I was finding with students when I first began teaching was that they couldn't solve problems, and I began to think about it. And if you look at the culture that students come out of now, do they spend their time playing cards? Do they spend their time playing board games? I think it's a much more passive kind of outside activity, maybe. Any comments here?
Let's see, what's your approach then?
What's my approach?
Yeah.
Again, what you're trying to do is help students develop the skills so that they can solve problems. So you talk about how to solve the problem. You don't stand up at the board and do the problem for the students and say, here's the answer. Or as one student was telling me just a month ago, they had the case where, you know, here was the problem. The professor had the problem and the answer, and the professor said to the students, gosh, I don't know how to get to the answer, but it's okay, you'll figure it out. You know? So there the students were, with nobody, first of all, doing the problem for them, first of all. Second of all, not showing them what the skills are that you need to solve the problem. So you have to teach strategies, and you have to talk about what goes on here as you try to figure out problems. Does that make sense?
Does your way eliminate a lot of the memorization?
I wouldn't say that it eliminates all of the memorization, because again, remember, you need a context for developing these skills. Yeah. You still have to memorize.
So about as much memory.
But you know why you're memorizing, you know where to put things when you memorize them so that you can get them out again. Mm-hmm. And you can get them out later. Because you've taken the time to build the storage closet in your head. Whereas, as opposed to me just giving it all to you and expecting you to do that, which I think what has been happening. Have you had problem solving experiences in science?
Not yet.
And what was your feeling about it?
Fine. I had only good experiences.
Yeah, okay, you like the challenge, huh? Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Well, for some people, you know, it works. but what I try to suggest is there are a lot of people who leave science. And they leave science because we're leaving out this part of providing the tools and the skills. Should we look at a few more here? Let's see, so repeated problem solving and memorization. Again, I think you can see here that I'm trying to suggest that learning is a process that requires skills. It means you have to teach how to learn, you have to teach how to question, you have to teach how to organize, connect, and relate information.
So these are things that people have not learned at all before?
Generally not. It's amazing, isn't it?
I understand what you're saying, but I think people should have learned some of these skills before they get to a chemistry class.
You would hope. You would hope, but what you find is they don't have it.
Some of us haven't even had a chemistry class. So.
But I mean, I don't think these things are really necessarily dependent upon having a chemistry class. I think a lot of the thought processes that go into them are quite standard in a sense. It's just that the thing you apply them to are a little bit different.
How did you develop your thought processes? I mean, what experiences did you have that helped you develop those thought processes? Because I know that I know that for me, going into science, into chemistry or physics or whatever, was not a comfortable situation, and that those problem solving, or at least in that particular context, that problem solving was very difficult for me. So what were your experiences that led to?
Was I always go back to a physical picture. Whenever I solve a problem, I have to think of, you know, if you could put everything in front of you, what would nature do? And then just try to describe that, I guess.
And how did that develop? How did that making a physical picture of it develop? Did you learn that along the line, or did it just come to you and it just worked for you? I mean, did you have a role model that helped
in terms
you
of a
that?
Person?
Uh-huh.
Not really a person that I can say sort of in that sense. You know, I had, a good high school chemistry teacher in terms of chemistry, but I guess just watching nature and sort of trying to understand
uh-huh.
that, yes.
Uh-huh. I guess, you know, because I was just trying to figure out, you know, if people, I don't remember ever developing that skill, and I don't know how that develops. And where does that come from? Do you need a role model to show you how to do that, or is it that when you were, you know, in grade school that your science teacher let you work those things out for yourself, or, you know, what?
It's an interesting question. It's really a question that people in the educational field are working really hard on right now, is how you develop critical thinking. Because it is a kind of thing. Yeah.
Well, I think we all pretty much accept the notion that children who have perhaps parents who have read to them or held them in their laps and read to them, those children tend to do better in their reading forever. But what happens, like these kinds of skills? Have parents sat around and taught them how to problem solve? No, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. But maybe some way they are.
Mm-hmm.
Or professors. I mean, I've had really good professors and really horrible professors. And it seems like the good professors, what they do is they never really teach you per se how to problem solve. But I think it's really difficult for any particular subject. So this is how you approach the problem solving. For I'm in medicine for fixing fractures and bodies. But the good ones understand that you don't have the knowledge that they have yet, and they can put themselves in your place. And see, you have to difficult point to understand. Let me explain better how shear works on dogleg, why a shear fracture is worse than a transverse fracture. Whereas the professors that needed help in teaching were ones who kind of like just expected you to leap up to their knowledge right away. And it wasn't so much, again, explaining how to problem solve, it was patiently letting you see them solving the problem and explaining it carefully how they're doing it. And then you kind of learn by the example, as opposed to ones who go, "Loop, this is how you do an electrocardiogram, learn it, and work at the bottom."
And what I'm trying to suggest is there's a particular reason why that style has developed for some people of "Loop, here it is," because that's what they believe about knowledge, that it's
uh-huh.
They give it to you,
mm-hmm.
because that's what they believe. Now, I want to make it clear that I'm not saying that this is wrong and this is right. What I'm saying is that this works for some people, as we've heard here, but that in my experience, what I see now for students as they come into science is that we need to be doing more of this. And again, I think we need to be more of doing this because we need to get to the point where we think of science as a way of knowing, not as a technique or a tool, I mean, not as, you know, kind of the ultimate goal is technology that we can use to make a bigger, better world, which I remember we're trying to move away from. Let's see. Let's look at a few more of these. There's the done only in one way, right, that you were talking about, that you have to do it the way your teacher does it, otherwise it's not correct. They somehow know how to do it, but they're not going to tell you that it's now they got to make you turn you into a man, so that they're not going to give you the test of manhood is to go out and figure it out on your own. I'm not going to tell you at all. Anybody have any experiences with the "it's a secret part"? You all laugh, so you knew what I was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
my experience in high school in physics, not so much in chemistry, but in physics, was that the secret part wasn't as much as this was done very quickly.
Uh-huh.
And it was a matter of those who were able did so quickly.
Uh-huh.
And those who weren't able simply dropped away and began to fail. So,
what kind of time period are you talking about?
Well, a semester.
Mm-hmm.
So 4 months.
Mm-hmm. A lot of heads shaking with that one, so.
Well, I can really relate. You know, it seems like if I missed one class, you know, it was impossible to get what I did.
Again, if you think of it as a language system, any day that you're out of your foreign language class, then you come back the next day and there's a whole new vocabulary sometimes.
Well, I think we see it also from the teacher's point of view in high school, and particularly in colleges. If the class size is too large, students are encouraged to drop out forcefully from the teacher by maybe giving some difficult work right at the beginning to discourage some people to drop out so the class size is more manageable. And we see it in high school, too.
Uh-huh. And I wonder, just thinking about this and about the whole idea of problem-solving skills and whatever, if that perhaps, and again, I've never taught high school science or even come real close to it, because I'm taking it myself a long time ago, that I'm wondering if maybe the goal of high school science and chemistry or in physics should not be so much as imparting the knowledge of chemistry or physics, but in helping students develop that technique of problem solving. And they use that with the tools of chemistry or physics. And so if they don't necessarily memorize those chemical formulas, or if they don't necessarily memorize the physics formulas, that what they have learned is the process of problem solving through this particular medium. I mean, I don't know. I somewhere along the line, problem solving, you know, learning how to solve problems needs to occur.
The critical thinking skills.
Yeah, the critical thinking skills.
Even in mathematics, the story problem is a lost art, and I think that's a lot of. Work. And this is, it's not just one day you're out of the chemistry class and you have to learn how to solve problems.
Sure.
I think it should be something that's gradual and
right.
It's taught throughout the curriculum. Because it's not just science. I mean.
Yeah, and you give me a word problem that says, you know, the car consumes 30 gallons a mile, and this car travels 12 and a half miles. You know, what was the rate of consumption? You know, it's like, what? I mean, that's just like, those are those English words, and I could give you the definition of all of those, but put those together, and it's like, you know, it's like reading Greek. No comprehension.
Yeah.
I found that it was easier for me to deal with a story problem than it was to deal with just a problem.
X and Y kind of thing?
Well, I never even got to that.
Yeah.
I'm talking, you know, even doing fractions, you know, but when there was a story and I could think, well, you know, is Biff going to get one half of the apple, you know, then I had something invested in it, you know, and it just made it a little more entertaining.
And I think that, yeah, please.
Another part of this, I guess, as I think of back on my experience, is maybe on the motivational end. And that is to somehow instill a sense of fascination with what you're studying. And at least when I think about my own experience in the earth sciences, studying earth history is like a big story. And it's one that I'm really fascinated in. And once you hear a piece of the story, then you start asking questions, well, how did you figure that out?
Mm-hmm.
And then you kind of work back into the logic of the problem solving. And I guess part of what I try to do as a teacher is to instill some of that enthusiasm and fascination with the story that they have some motivation to go on.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And I'm sure because you do have that love of the story, it comes across.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought when I was basically teaching that, oftentimes they needed to know why this was interesting. You know, that one of the first things you had to do was to tell them why this was interesting stuff. Because otherwise, they just, you know, why didn't listen? You know, they copied down everything you said, but nothing was registering.
Yeah. And that's what you talked about earlier, that the history, the whole, you know, that beginning stuff is so important, and I think oftentimes that's skipped. You know, that's the chapter that's rushed through, and maybe they had a little more understanding of, you know, what was going on.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. Have you got any thoughts about why they're like that? Why they need the why?
Well, a lot of people don't encounter science, or they don't think about science in their everyday life at all. They don't really, it doesn't really seem relevant to them. It's just something that they're studying so that they can get into med school. But it does not seem relevant to their experience at all. Unless you sort of give them a little more background as to what this really means about, you know, their life, or what this means about what they're going into, or what this means historically, they have some context to put it in. You know, instead of just hanging facts in the air, they have something to hang it all on.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Another part of it would be instilling a little confidence early on. I taught several years in the Minnesota Community College system. On many occasions would have older women who had come back to school and were just completely intimidated by science and had gone through their whole program straight A's and put off the science to the very last minute and still came in with just absolutely trembling at the thought of having to take science. And you can kind of get them involved and build some confidence right at the start in that thinking process. It makes a big difference.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to just single out older women with that. Right?
No.
My experience is that I see it.
Yeah, that's my experience with community college. I've got all liberal arts, I want an associate degree in science and math.
So forget it.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm self-employed, and I never did go to college. Okay, so and I'm a builder, and I do my own architectural designing and building. And what I do, as far as solving a problem, I lay it out on paper, and then of course, then after it's laid out on paper, I decide what the cost factor is and what it takes as far as what it takes for the materials to put the to become a product. And I mean, you got to start with the foundation to love, and then after you make it full circle, you solve the problem. I don't know what.
Well, I think what you're suggesting is that kids need to have more hands-on experience.
Yeah.
That too often in science experiences or science programs, at least even at the college level, the labs are fill in the blank. So what that tells you is that there's a right answer and there's a wrong answer, and that you've got to get all these answers in these blanks, and it's no longer a question of exploration. And now, granted, there are some problems, like how are you going to make sure they don't blow up the lab if you just say no to it? But it seems like those problems could be solved if we put some time and effort into it. There were some nods. Yeah.
I was just wondering if you ever find this very much. In my science classes, I did really well in the abstract idea part of it, and just lousy in the lab.
Uh-huh.
So the hands-on part, something about it wasn't doing it for me.
Uh-huh.
Do you find that happening?
Yeah, and I think that's because the connection isn't made from one to the other, that you're not really developing a pair of glasses that you put on and then you walk into the lab and see it for yourself. That it's abstract, like you say, and you're disconnected from what you're doing, so that you can't carry it in to the classroom. Because it doesn't really become a way of knowing for you. That you just really, it's this gaming strategy again.
I have the theory.
Yeah.
I'm mainly liberal arts. I'm one of those who was always afraid of science because that's a mechanical realm that I can't fit into. But I've always had a theory that good teaching is primarily a matter of asking questions and stimulating their questions. And in this give and take of questioning things, you gradually get a broad knowledge. Now, how applicable is that to this?
Well, I think that's part of it.
Yeah.
But what I'm trying to suggest is that it's a very complicated process, and it's not just, again, a mind that does questioning, it's a human being that does questioning. And so you have to address, you have to build self-esteem, you have to talk about, well, how are you feeling at this point? You know, how did you feel with your success there? How did you feel with your difficulty? But certainly that's part of it, but it's just not enough. I can tell you from my own experience that when I started teaching, I thought, well, you know, I'll just be enthusiastic because I really love my story. I'll get the storylines down and have all these great demonstrations, and then everybody's going to learn wonderfully. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't work. That you have to step into the shoes of the student and ask, you know, what's going on. And then again, I think this other fundamental philosophical point is an important one, that you have to see the knowledge as something that it has been constructed by somebody else. And that way you can help students reconstruct it. I just want to talk for a minute here about really what I would consider to be a tragedy of human resource because of science experiences that students have. And just show you some statistics. I know you've probably all heard of the serious problem that people think we have with not having enough students, not having enough people going to science. And recently, I guess there was a report that someone thinks that those statistics were fudged. Would you like to say a little bit about that?
Heinrich Block, who was the head of the NSF during most of the Reagan years and early Bush years, was given a survey by a staff which essentially said that in X number of years we will be 50% under what we need in terms of scientists and engineers. And so we have to have a lot of money for NSF so we can get a lot of engineers and scientists produced. And then I think what's sounding like now from articles is that this person took a very incomplete study and wanted to push it to get more science funding from the Congress, when in fact people in their own staff didn't really think it was that good of a study. Wasn't complete, didn't consider a lot of production loss, so to speak, of scientists. And I think there's been this flavor of, oh, we need more and more and more and more scientists, otherwise we're not going to compete in the world. And perhaps even in the future that will be true, that we do need more scientists, but the level which it was proposed seems like, well, there was an aspect which was more just for funding than for real. You're trying to get people who have a real interest in doing science and enjoying them. Is that what you were...
Yeah. So the exact need that we have for scientists, I guess, is controversial at this point. But this plus our own experiences tell us that there's a real graying of the academic scientist population. From 1973 to 1987, the percentage of scientists under the age of 35 fell to 12% of all academic scientists from 27%. So what that means is in the next few years, more and more are going to be retiring, and we're going to certainly need people to replace academic scientists if we want the scientific enterprise to continue. And the point that I really want to make is that we want people to go into science not so that science can be done in the same old way, but so that the scientific enterprise can be transformed, that people aren't going to go into it, it's never going to change. And what we need is to see more people, more diverse people, going into the enterprise so that the character of it can change. Let me just show you some more statistics. In the 10th grade, these came out of the NSF now, so again, with any statistic, it's kind of hard to know exactly. For sure what's going on here, but in the 10th grade, I think this was 1988, something like that, there were 2 million white male students. There were also 2 million women and people of color who were students in the 10th grade. All right. But then as we go further, of course, fewer and fewer people go to college, so entering college, we have 500,000 white males, and then we have 100,000 women and people of color doing science. And then they take their first year, their introductory courses in science. And now we get to 250,000 white males taking introductory science. And, oh dear, I've got the same number twice. Well, it drops here, it must drop dramatically. I think it's more like 10. I just want to get my numbers straight here. I don't want to mislead anybody. Not with those numbers. Let's see. After that first year, we're down to, oh, I don't know, maybe 50,000, something like that, roughly.
That's after the first year?
That's after the first year. That,
who graduates?
Who graduates, okay. I just have the figures in chemistry. So in chemistry, in 1988, we had 5,500 men and 3,500 women. That's with the bachelor's degree. And then when we ask them how much further they go, with PhD, let me see, I have that here. You know how it is with statistics. Let's see.
It's a much better ratio than after the first year.
Than after the first year, right. You mean men to women. Right, right. That first year is a real killer. Well, for anyone who's lived through it, we can speak to that. I don't have the numbers. For example, well, here, I just have women, I guess. In 1989, here it is. 362 women got a PhD in chemistry in the United States. And 1,800 men got a PhD in chemistry. Which, I mean, it's fascinating to have actually those numbers there.
I think if you look at the growth also, though, well, how the numbers are changing over time, you'll see that the number of women are increasing very rapidly.
Right.
Compared to the rate of change of men.
Right. Right. Well, and part of that is that the white male population is declining, too, so there's that factor going on. There are a lot of mentoring programs now that you may have heard some in your community that are bringing women and people of color into science. I have a particular thing I always like to check out with those mentoring programs, and that is, are we wanting to encourage students to go into science as it's currently practiced? Don't we want, rather, to encourage students to go into the scientific enterprise so that they can be part of some kind of transformation? That I would not want to recruit, necessarily, people into an enterprise as it currently stands, I think. But we have to ask that some changes take place. Yeah?
I missed part of this.
Yeah.
Maybe you covered this. But do you see any difference in the learning program, or as you would envision it, between students who aren't going to become scientists and those who are, in terms of how they learn science and the kind of ideal course for them?
Yeah, I think part of the problem that we have in science education is that it's a curriculum designed to train people to go into science. So it doesn't matter if you're going to be a nurse, a doctor, a veterinarian, a nutritionist expert. Everyone takes the same curriculum. And that's really, first of all, silly, because not everyone's going to end up in the same place. And second of all, it doesn't develop that notion of science as a way of knowing. Yeah?
I don't know if you read any of Sheila Tobias's
book
about how the kind of rigorous socialization process that scientific training really is.
Yeah.
And I thought when I was in graduate school that, I went in and I wanted to teach at a small college. That's what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. Well, I found out real quick that I was considered sort of second class, if that's what I wanted.
Exactly.
And so I tried to make myself want to go the whole route of writing grants and getting a lab and, hobnobbing with the right people at meetings and stuff. But that's never really what I wanted.
Right.
But I felt like that's what I had to want.
Right.
To be in that system and to be respected in that mm-hmm. system. Those were the things it was okay for you to want.
Right.
And I eventually ended up leaving and no desire to do science ever again. So,
after years of investment.
Yeah.
Well, I know exactly what you're saying. I did my graduate work at the University of Chicago, where everyone is expected to go off to a primary research institution and do research and write grants. When I left, I did not tell a single soul that I was going to teach at an ELCA college. But for me to say that would have been, I would have been betraying the system. And nobody asked me where I was going, so. Another part of the socialization. So I think that we have to recognize, you know, with all of these numbers, that there are barriers there for people in science, and it's not the fact, it's really not the case that people can't do science. It's that those barriers are there. And particularly for women and people of color, some of those barriers have come out of the enterprise themselves. I always like to just tell a story that I heard when I was at a women's college that was celebrating its 100-year reunion, where their question was, they said that 100 years ago people were saying, are women fit for college? Because 100 years ago, biologically, it was said that if women went to college and used their brains, they would never be able to have babies. 100 years ago, they didn't say anything like that. So the question really now is higher education fit for women? I think we could say the same thing about science. You know, is it that people aren't fit for science, or is it that science is not fit for people?
Cheryl, I have a question here.
Sure.
Concerning this. Probably totally irrelevant, but something I've been pondering. In the past, things we've needed in the United States, we've got from our colonies or other countries. Would there be anything wrong with getting these engineers, scientists, and so on from foreign countries? I mean, the world has, you know, a fair amount of scientists and that. And our current political immigration laws, I don't know that they necessarily are very conducive to that. Most of what I see coming in, green cards from Mexico, are not exactly. I think it's a political decision, to be very honest. And if we need that, it's certainly available in the world. And in the past, the United States has got what they needed from the world.
I guess I'd like to hear how the group would respond to that.
Well, some of the graduate programs were 50 to 70% foreign students.
Oh, yes, back years ago when I was. I mean, yes.
Well, I think it's gotten even higher today.
There was some, I know someone who was in some engineering program at Wisconsin, and basically if you were a white, there are all these scholarships that were available. If you were a white student going into that department, you just had this scholarship. There were so many foreign students and there were so few white students.
Right.
Let me rephrase the question then. If Americans don't want to do science, I'm saying the majority, don't want to do science, don't care to do engineering work, should we want them to want to do that? Or should we just go ahead and do, not myself, but I mean those that don't want to do that, can they just go ahead and do business or whatever it is they want to do, and again, bring the specialized thing in? Is there something wrong with that?
Yeah, well, I would just say that the figures there show that a lot more people want to do it than are able to do it. You know, for some reason, there's some kind of barriers in that process that prevent some people from doing what they really like to do.
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily say it's not wanting to do it.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing, that I don't think it's not wanting to do it. I think it's the feeling from, you know, from your experience in a science classroom that you are unable to do it the way they are asking you to do it. And so, you know, when you fail, when you feel like you're failing at what's happening, or you're not able to do what they're at, I mean, you know, if you can get a 4 point in graduate school in liberal arts or in education or in English, you should be able to take a science course and do relatively well. I mean, I think it's not that you're not bright enough to do it. It's just that there's something there that's, you know, that's getting in the way.
May I flip the coin over then? I have a fascination with foreign languages, and I can think of nothing that would be more exciting than to travel the world speaking 20 foreign different tongues. However, I have a problem. I can't conjure verbs. Therefore, I went into engineering. Now, should I come back to the language department and say, your problem, you're doing something totally wrong, and do we need to, you follow my...
Well, remember, I'm not trying to suggest right or wrong. What I'm suggesting is if we want a more diverse group of people into science, if we want to see the enterprise become more just, we've got to ask ourselves, why don't people do science?
We have enough people speaking foreign languages then. You're happy with that part of it. We don't need to be concerned with that.
Well, maybe they need to reform the way they're teaching
sure.
the language.
Sure,
right,
sure.
Exactly.
I think they're coming here first. Yeah.
No, I was just thinking, just from the terms, just in response, is that it's not just a matter of that everybody wants to be professional scientists, but the fact that, you know, science is a lot of times really fascinating. And the fact is, we live in a technological world, it's not going to go backwards. People are still going to want their cars, and we're not ready to transfer automobiles yet. We still fly planes, you know, we still are funding research institutions. Certainly, diseases are always going to be cropping up. And so it's good for people to understand that. And a lot of it's really beautiful. And it's a shame that somehow they can't convey that. Like, for example, the popularity of the shows like Cosmos or The Living Earth when it comes on PBS. People love those shows because somehow they're managing to touch the fascination that's not coming through in some academic setting.
Yeah.
Well, interesting. You should raise Cosmos. Got Carl Sagan week, Cosmos.
Yeah.
Because I wonder about that a little bit. I don't want to question what you said, but it seems to me that the kind of popular ancient scientist, Carl Sagan, I mean, we're not just talking about a way of knowing, we're talking about the way of knowing.
The
way of knowing everything. Mm-hmm. And that's, for me, that's kind of off-putting.
Well, I think we could find a compromise here.
Yeah, sure.
And what we want to illustrate is the joy of science, knowing natural phenomena, sure. Understanding what the limitations are. Mm-hmm. You had a comment?
Yeah, well, she said part of it.
Yeah.
You know, I part of my interest is that everybody should be excited about science and learning about it, like I didn't really. But then another part of the question is the profession of being a scientist part of the problem? I mean, maybe we've got some very excellent students who could do it, but who don't want to because they don't see that profession, that career of being a scientist as something that they want to do.
Yeah, I think part of that goes back to the comment up here about the socialization in graduate mm-hmm. school, which continues on into the profession. I don't know, it's a pretty homogeneous group at the moment, I would say. I mean, yeah.
One of the problems, I think, is you started outlining there is
yeah.
access also. I work at a University of Wisconsin System University, and for the last 3 years, we've been decreasing the number of students we've been accepting. And at the same time, we're tripling the number of prison cells that we have in the state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
right. And so the governor is committed to reduce the number of college-educated people in the state of Wisconsin. I mean, it's a policy.
Wow.
It's a state policy.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's too expensive to continue supporting a higher education.
Wow.
Less expensive than prisons.
That seems to be what the program is, yes. But I would say that that's not unique in Wisconsin. I think you will find a lot of other states that you're all from that are doing similar type things, where they are cutting back on the numbers of people that they're taking into colleges. Once you're even into the system, what you will find oftentimes is perhaps the chemistry department will only allow so many majors. And that you have to have maybe a 2.8 or a 3.0 even to be accepted
uh-huh.
into the undergraduate program.
Uh-huh.
So suddenly you've got students who are doing okay with their grade point average, but it's not high enough to get into one of the science areas. So they end up going into some other area. And so we're selecting them out of the sciences at an early age.
Uh-huh. Okay,
I know at least from my experience, some of the people who ended up being the best scientists were not the ones who did the best in their coursework. And that there are some people who they would make exceptions for because
uh-huh.
they're so outstanding
uh-huh.
scientists that they just weren't that great
uh-huh.
at the coursework.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
In a previous conversation on this topic, maybe months ago, it was suggested maybe we structure our majors upside down. We sort of, in an intro course, have lots of memorization and terms and sort of try and give the broad overview of the field and gradually lead them through to a more sophisticated critical thinking skills. And that maybe if we started with an intro course that introduced the critical thinking skills, and then maybe cap it off with a broad overview, which they could appreciate because now they understood the discipline. Maybe the whole structure of the enterprise is upside down.
Yep.
One quick thought on that grade point and entrance to school. I remember in engineering school, math classes in particular, the first thing we would do in a class of 30 is count the number of Chinese in there. And this is back more than 20 years ago. You counted the number of Chinese in there, and you knew there were five A's. And if there were more than five Chinese in there, that's where the A's were, because they all went to math graduate schools in foreign countries before they came here to enroll in the undergraduate engineering courses. And that's part of what I was referring to about bringing them in through immigration laws.
Mm-hmm. Well, our time
is television causing elementary school children to have an interest in science?
Causing?
Is it developing any curiosity?
I think that the jury is mixed on that one. There's some evidence now, but
I think it's a medium that we haven't really seen where we can take it yet.
Right.